Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
On today's podcast, I am not on the show. I'm just doing the intro, dropping in and saying a little bit of housekeeping and saying hello. John Pigeon will be joined by Vince Scully. I'm taking a couple of weeks off recording while I recover. They'll be talking about Hex and Help Debt. They'll be talking about kids investing and different accounts for kids. A lot of stuff in there. They have a really good discussion around investing, multiple accounts, brokerages, Hex and Help Debt. And, you know, as usual, you'll be in good hands. But just a bit of housekeeping. We do have our annual census still out at the moment. You can complete that. Thanks for your feedback. I've noticed a couple of comments in there, and I'm talking to our regular listeners right now. A couple of people saying too many ads. Just on that, that's one way that we make money to bring this podcast to you. And just in terms of too many ads, I believe on most podcast plays, there's a 15-second skip button that can be used for that. But more broadly, how the commercial codes work for ads, usually you can't have more than 15 to 16 minutes per hour of content of ads. And podcasting is the Wild West and it's not really regulated. We're not under any broadcasting laws. It's just really good to see that as a guide. Secondly, SBS and community radio can't have more than 5 minutes per hour. So what we really want to do, most episodes are an hour on the main show. And thanks for your grace while we just try and experiment with a couple of things with our ad software. We're thinking two pre-roll ads. One of those ads will be a voiceover artist doing different products and random things. And we're still kind of working that out. I had an ad removed for incontinence pads the other day and just scrapped that category because I don't think that represents most of our listeners. So any like things that aren't that relevant, we'll scrub out. And then we may run campaigns. Us, Simo, will run our own internal announcements or other sponsorships. So pre-roll, which is before the show, random voiceover person might be 30 seconds long. Then up to 40 seconds for a host read ad, which is me. And the same for the mid-roll in the middle of the show. Now, when we do launch back up next year, we may have another show partner that might get a 30-second burned-in ad at the start of the podcast. But that's just a guide, and that is how I help to pay our team's salaries and wages each week. I do thank you for your support. We only really like to work with brands, particularly when my voice or any of the show host's voices are attached to that ad. It is something that we personally are happy with and we've looked at ourselves. But if there's a random voiceover person advertising a barbecue, well, that's just in the random pool and whatever. But yeah, thanks for your feedback. But honestly, I did, before I started running all these ads, I put a post up in the Facebook group and I asked people, do you want ads or would you rather pay a Patreon thing and get an RSS fee, which is the podcast feed, without any ads at all? We'll strip it all out, pay a monthly subscription. I think there was around 2% of people that wanted that option. So thank you everyone for your support and allowing us to make money to provide the content to you. And as you'll see from this episode, we do a lot of user-generated content. We talk about the things that you're talking about in the Facebook group. And finally, and apologies, I have gone a little bit long with this housekeeping, but this is your podcast and the regulars who listen to this, I like to keep you informed with what we're doing and around this housekeeping stuff. So we'll get into it. And just by a rule of thumb, the Tuesday and Thursday main show, we like to be in the meat. I'm looking at the template now. When I do my intro and a little bit of housekeeping and a bit of a show partner shout out with the music under it, our template has the bump that goes into the main intro before it starts at about 3 minutes, 3 minutes 20. So we like to be into the meat, into the conversation by around 3 to 4 minutes, absolute max. Okay, so that's our guide. Now I've gone over today because I just wanted to tell you guys about our housekeeping, about some of the things that we are experimenting, particularly the Might Millennial Investor podcast. That's a shorter podcast. we had the setting set up two ads. It was too long. So I've dropped that down to one ad pre, one ad mid-roll, one ad at the end. So thank you for your patience. We are working to make this a really good experience for you. And it is my goal that we'll never just interrupt the course of conversations with an ad. We'll always tell you there's an ad coming up. So that's really important to me. So thank you so much. I will see you soon. You're in great hands with Vince and John in this episode. So I'm Glenn James, and you're listening to My Millennial Money.
Vince, I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, I do love a good Q&A, especially with you.
Absolutely. So, Megan Young. Hi, everyone. I'm 28 years old, got a pretty high HECS debt, $129,000, and earning roughly $85,000 per year. I've done some rough calculations and it may take me at least 20 years to pay back, meaning I'll be at least 48 until it is all paid back. Hypothetically, if I retire early at 45 and live off income from my super and investments, but still have some HECS debt remaining, would I still have to be paying back my HECS debt despite not actually earning a salary? Note, if you're wondering how I incurred such a large debt, I did both a bachelor and master's degree. I didn't get a CSP for my master's. Vince, Megan's well studied.
Megan's obviously a very intelligent young woman. I mean, I guess this is a bit about HECS doing the job it's designed to do. And talking about it as a debt is something that always bothers me. I know that's what the government calls it, but Yes. It's sort of an accounting fudge that really it's a graduate tax surcharge with a lifetime cap and your debt is the bit that's unpaid. So
talk to the listeners, first of all, about the threshold.
Yeah. So the theory about HECS is that a university education is good for both the person who gets it and for society as a whole. So society as a whole pays for some of your degree through the tax system, and you pay for some of it through the HECS system. But you only have to pay if you got a financial benefit from doing the degree. So it's the ultimate try before you buy. So the repayments are collected through the tax system. So if you earn more than the threshold, which escapes me for a moment.
75 or 80 or something, isn't it?
I will quickly check it in the black book while I'm talking. But if you earn above the threshold, you pay an additional tax to effectively amortize the debt that you've accumulated. And obviously, if you don't earn above the threshold, you never pay it back. So you could go your whole lifetime, not get an increased pay because of your degree, and therefore never repay it. And that's why I like to think about it as more of a tax surcharge.
And it's the only debt that we can take to our grave.
That's right. There was some talk about fixing that or changing that, but that's never happened. And I don't think there's much political appetite for doing it.
No,
but generally, if you don't earn above the threshold, you don't pay it back. And the more you earn, the faster you pay it back. That's the theory.
So in Megan's example, if she wants to retire at 45, living off the income from her super, provided that super is enough for her, she won't need to pay that back.
Well, the test for income is effectively taxable income plus a few add backs. So when they're saying, well, what's the relevant income here for the HECS test? It's your taxable income plus salary sacrifice, super contributions, plus some fringe benefits, plus net investment losses, plus a few other bits and pieces. So anything that's taxable gets counted towards your HECS threshold. So if you're living off your investments, that's considered no different than earning the salary.
Yeah. So I suppose hypothetically, like her, I'm saying that if she's under the threshold from she's drawing down from her super, she wouldn't need to pay that HECS debt back.
Correct. Now, the second half of that question is living off her super, which is a bit more interesting because super over 860 is not taxable. It doesn't get counted in your taxable income and therefore doesn't get counted for HECS purposes. Mm. So when you actually turn 60 and start earning a tax-free pension, that income doesn't count for HECS. So I've seen quite a few 58-year-olds going back to uni to do that degree they always wanted to do,
yes,
and in effect never paying for it. So,
but if she's wanting to retire at 45, she won't be able to live off her super because she won't be able to access it.
That's right. So she'll need to hit a condition of release. So unless she's planning on becoming totally and permanently disabled at 45, she'll have to wait till 60 to get it.
Absolutely. Rough way to go about that.
But, you know, I suspect that she's possibly underestimating how quickly she'll pay it off.
Yeah.
That if you start applying, you know, annual increases and CPI to her income, and, you know, depending on what the government does with the thresholds, I haven't redone the numbers, but I suspect 48 might be an overestimate given that she's earning, you know, close to average incomes.
Yeah.
And so we'll see some increases even if they're capped out. I think in that – I saw that thread in the group during the week, and I think she might have said she was likely to cap out at about 100.
Yeah.
So that would accelerate that payment.
Okay. So I suppose supporting your comments initially on this, the focus needs to be off the HEX debt,
yeah,
and onto creating wealth in other means
and not
worrying about this debt, because it's not credit card debt, it's not personal loan debt, it's not terrible debt.
I mean, it does obviously affect the amount of income you've got available to spend. It does affect the amount of income you've got available to support a home loan if you want. So it will reduce your borrowing, but it's not a debt in the true sense. So it dies with you. But oddly enough, it does survive bankruptcy. So if you declare bankruptcy, your HEX debt doesn't go away.
Damn.
So there's some upsides and downsides.
There is, yeah. And I suppose on a finishing note, I don't know how much HEX debt is normal out there these days, because it's continually going up.
The average is about 30.
Yeah. So it's on the high side.
At graduation.
Mm. So it's very much on the high side. But as you said, Megan, you've got a bachelor and a master's, so you pay for that. I've always been of the opinion that HEX debt is good debt, as long as you're using what you accumulated that debt for.
That's right. And people do get a bit, and this is me defending my position as a boomer here, people do go, oh, you boomers had it easy, education was free. Well, it was actually only free for about a decade. From the Whitlam government to the Hawke government.
Yeah, so, bit of history here.
So that's not long in the scheme of things. So this notion that university education used to be free was only true for a very short period of time.
For a 10-year period for these older folk.
Don't quote me on the 10, but it was from Whitlam, which, when was this?
It was the 70s, wasn't it?
The dismissal was 74.
Yes.
And Hawke was early 80s,
Bob
but he left some good beer behind him.
He did, and still drinks it today, I think. Great question, Megan. Thank you. Christine McDonald says, I have set up trading accounts for my kids, grandparents, and we contribute to them all EFT and dividend reinvented, or should be reinvested, I believe. But now
you could reinvent them.
You could reinvent them. But now that I have four kids, the brokerage each time is times four. I'm thinking I should close them and amalgamate them all in my own account for now and split the money when they are older, conscious of tax here. Is there a better way to set this up? There is no better guy on this planet to answer this than Vince.
Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff to unpack here, John. We've got a bit of tax. We've got a bit of brokerage. We've got a bit of, you know, best way to give your kids money. Certainly, if you're investing small amounts of money and then dividing it four ways, brokerage will become a material sum, even though brokerage is way cheaper than it used to be.
I mean,
you used to be paying, you know, $100 plus for a trade. Today, it can be as low as five.
Yes.
But there are ways of investing without paying brokerage. So managed funds will allow you to invest odd numbers, often by BPAY, without triggering brokerage. It can take a bit of research to find them, but you could certainly go to Vanguard Investor, for example.
Something like a Vanguard.
Or some of the Colonial Thrift State products. Yep. But it does take a bit of digging to do it. But many of those can be bought without brokerage. There is a buy-sell spread. Usually that's the difference between the price you buy it at and the price you would sell it at. But that's a percentage. So, and usually it's very small, so that would be one way of cutting down your brokerage.
Mm.
The second thing is to think about the tax here, and Christine sort of alludes to that in her question. kids under 18 don't get the tax-free allowance for passive income. That's income they haven't earned by working. So depending on how much we're talking about here, they could be paying 60% tax on the dividends, even if they are reinvested. So having material amounts of money in your kid's name is probably not a good look. And it can get a bit complicated. You know, whose tax file number do you provide to the provider? Who's controlling the money that's being spent? You know, when the dividend comes in, does it go into mum's bank account? All those things will go to drive the tax implications. If you are talking about material amounts of money where the capital gains tax on eventual transfer could be material, you might consider looking at investment bonds, which your kids would get tax-free after 10 years. There is tax paid along the way, but depending on your personal tax rate, and certainly if it would be a lower tax than it was in the kid's name because of that penalty tax. And, of course, keeping it to one side keeps it out of sight, out of mind. The number of times over the years I've seen people set up accounts for their kids at birth and the money doesn't last past childcare fees.
No.
That you get to, you know, year two or three,
yeah,
and you've got three kids at childcare, suddenly your appetite for investing disappears and the money gets withdrawn.
Yeah.
So all of those things need to be considered. You know, I always say never let the tax tail wag the investment dog.
Yeah, and I was just about to add to that is, okay, we're talking about brokerage and we're talking about paying tax or minimising it. Do we have the wrong focus here?
Yeah. I mean, certainly if you're looking at a long-term investment, and I mean truly a long-term, like from birth to age 18 or 21, where you're confident that you're going to stay the course, then, yeah, a few dollars of brokerage here or there probably doesn't make a huge difference.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you're investing, you know, $50 a week and paying four times $5 in brokerage,
totally,
obviously that's eating into the investment.
Yeah.
But certainly you've got to focus on the goal first, get the investment right, and then worry about tax and brokerage.
Yeah, I think the great thing here for Christine is she's not only thinking about it, but she's applying it. So she's investing and she's looking at it for the future of her kids.
Yep.
It's just now just ironing out the weeds, maybe just look at some other options like potentially a Vanguard where there's you can split them by child, can't you?
You can. Need to think about your actual behaviour around that determines whether it really is the kids or not and whether it really being the kids is a good thing or a bad thing.
Yes.
The other thing that's worth considering without overcomplicating this is some of the older listed investment companies like AFIC, Australian Foundation Investment Company, they have what's called a share sacrifice or share substitution scheme,
okay,
where instead of getting a dividend, which would be taxable, you get a share issued to you, which isn't taxable, but it's got a zero cost base for CGT preps. So when you eventually sell it, you'll pay capital gains on the whole amount. Mm. But over a long period, that's a good thing. The downside, though, is you don't get franking on that dividend, and you don't get the LIC offset, which sort of compensates LIC investors for not getting the capital gains tax discount on distributed capital gains.
Mm. Okay.
So if you're a top rate taxpayer and you're happy with the investment strategy of AFIC, that could be a way to go. If you're a lower rate taxpayer, the giving up the franking credits and the offset probably undo much of the benefit.
Okay. Good stuff, Christine. Well done.
But so, I'd love to be one of Christine's four kids.
Yeah, well, it sounds like she put a lot of energy towards it, so that it should work out well. Kim Tapley, this one here.
This is the toughest bit. You know,
yes.
People talk about finance being complicated, but it's really the psychology, behaviour and relationships around it that cause most of the problems.
It might actually have nothing to do with financial planning.
So read Kim's question.
Yeah, so I desperately need some advice on financial planning. My partner has no interest in speaking with a professional. He thinks they're just rip-off agents. I've asked him to read The Barefoot Investor so we can talk and try and hash out a plan ourselves, but that's fallen in deaf ears. At the stage of my life, not having a plan is causing much anxiety.
Presumably to her, not to her partner.
Not to him. He's travelling along just fine by the sounds. We live day to day, pay to pay. I could really use some advice about how to try to plan for the future when my other half won't even talk about it. Does anyone know of any low-cost financial planning agencies or courses? Thanks. Now, let's start with the last sentence for you, Vince, because I know this might tickle a nerve or
yes,
two.
Yes, this is this is what we do at Life Sherpa. This is what I've dedicated my twilight years to. And one of the things that we do is, well, we put it together originally for newly engaged couples. We have a pre-marriage program, which we call Money Vows, which takes people through 10 guided conversations around money.
Yes.
And in each one, they make a vow to each other. So it's a good way of dealing with goals, values, personality, dealing with debt, dealing with making money decisions, dealing with the in-laws and money, all those sort of things that you've got to get yourself together. And obviously Kim and her partner have been together for some time by the looks of it, so they may not be newly engaged, but that sort of thing would be extremely useful. But, you know, I think most people, whether they're in a relationship or not, don't want to be told what to do. And the Barefoot Investor, you know, having sold more books in Australia than anything other than the Bible, is a force to be reckoned with, but it is very much a this-is-the-way-you-must-do-it approach to finance. And, you know, there is a reason it's called personal finance, and that's because it's personal.
Yes.
So to be told, you know, what to do is likely to raise more hackles than it solves. Clearly, this is more of a relationship and values and goals discussion rather than a true financial planning. But usually in a partnership, you usually get one who's more keen than the other. And quite often these days, it is the woman who takes the lead on these things. But, you know, badgering a partner into it and, you know, force-fitting some particular author's specific way when it may or may not fit your needs is a difficult, if not dangerous, place to start. And certainly I'm not a fan of mixing money discussions with date night. I think every couple should have a date night, but to mix a discussion around money into what should be a sociable, happy, joyful occasion strikes me as being an odd way. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't have a money date, but I think mixing the two is a bad look. But this is clearly an alignment of values, goals, and life stage.
Yep, totally.
And, it's not a money problem specifically, but it is one that's important for Kim and her partner to sort out. But badgering someone into it is only going to make it worse.
Look, and thanks for reaching out, Kim. It's such a common problem. I see it, and I'm sure you do as well, Vince.
Yeah, but absolutely.
I think you're right. It's values and beliefs and goals, and know that as a couple, if we're in it for the long journey and we're maybe going to have kids, we've got to be on the same page, generally speaking, in life. Right now, everyone has their different goals and different values, but generally speaking, if they don't align, that can be the difference between staying together or not.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if you look at the markers of long successful relationships, aligned values is the number one marker. Now, aligned doesn't have to mean the same.
No.
That's important. And in fact, identical would probably be as bad or worse than
probably
than diametrically
just butt heads.
But it is important. And a lot of these differences come around sort of four main areas. The three of those sort of start to show when you actually start talking about it. But, you know, first, willingness to talk about it, and that sort of comes back to, well, what do we see money as? You know, is money can mean love, money can mean power, money can mean prestige, money can mean security, and getting to the bottom of your money personality would be quite useful. what we have a free tool on our website that might help you get to the bottom of your personality. If you Google Life Sherpa Money Personality, it'll get you there, and it's free. So try it out. The three are usually around debt and borrowing, giving. So, you know, if one party is very keen on donating to philanthropic causes or a church and the other isn't. And the third one is family, you know, sharing money with family. But, you know, Kim looks like it's getting to talk about these issues rather than the issues themselves is the problem.
Yeah, so we all know we can lead a horse to water. It doesn't drink necessarily. So just knowing, Kim, that you do need to sit down with your partner and have a good, solid conversation and say, well, this is where I'm at. This is where I want to go. These are my goals. These are my values around what I want to provide for us and for our family or potential family. Are you on board? And he might turn around and say, well, I couldn't care less about money. Mm-hmm. I just want to have a beer at a pub on a Friday night and work and live happily ever after. And that's cool. But if she hasn't got his support, it's very much a different conversation now, isn't it? But if he says, yeah, look, go for your life, Kim, I'll support you, but I'm not going to be reading Barefoot Investor and carving up our money. Like, you can control that. Yeah. I'm happy for you to do that. But I think if that's not alignment, eventually there may be some hard conversations had.
Yeah, and I think that the timing and how you approach that discussion is important. Like, it's not something to do when someone walks in the door from a tough day at work or their footy team's just lost on a Saturday.
Yes.
And approaching it from this is how I feel rather than you don't listen to me when I talk about money.
Yeah.
Look, I feel anxious because I don't feel in control of our finances. Can you help me get there is a much better approach than you never want to talk about money.
Yeah, yeah. And the worst thing you can do is corner him into a conversation with a financial planner. That would be disaster.
Yeah.
So without knowing both of your personalities, Kim, I think it's just sitting down and having a good, solid conversation and see where that takes you. Advice on financial planning, I honestly don't think you're there yet.
Mm.
I think there's some back-end stuff that needs to be fixed.
Yeah. But, yeah, try the money personality test. Get each of you to do it. It will tell you stuff about why you do what you do with money. And could be very revealing and provide a framework to have a non-threatening, informed conversation.
Yeah, it can't be blaming. It can't be any of that stuff that's targeted. So, yeah. Good one, Kim. Thanks for reaching out. Let's take a break and we'll be back in just a jiff.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, Simon Little. Hey, guys, would love to know how people decide when to sell shares. I had three different lithium companies I have held since 2017, all up a considerable amount. Curious if people sell half at a certain point or just risk the corrections if the money is not required.
Interesting question, Simon.
Yeah. Sell at the top when you need it, when you want to buy a house, when you want to go on a holiday. So many different emotions running through
there
with profit.
There is, and emotions is a very key one here. But I think the more scientific answer to your question is it depends on whether you're a trader or an investor. If you're a trader, that is, you're buying short-term on the premise that it's going to go up, and if it doesn't go up, you want to close out your position and sell, because when you're trading, controlling how much you lose is almost more important than how much you make. So in those cases, the secret is to run your gains and cut your losses. Mm-hmm. So if you buy a company with a particular thesis that says, I think it's going to go up because of X, and it doesn't go up and X happens, or X doesn't happen and it still doesn't go up, then you should be cutting your position. But if your thesis proves to be true and it does go up, which sounds like it might have in your lithium case, you should let your gains run. If it then becomes too big a percentage of your trading pot, you probably want to start taking some money off the table. So if you had a $100,000 trading pool and you were allocating $5,000 to a trade, on the basis that if you lost $5,000, it was a manageable loss. When that $5,000 got to, you know, 10 or 15 or whatever your strategy is, that's a time to take some money off the table. But if it's still running, you should let your gains run. Mm. If you're an investor, on the other hand, though, you want to stop a particular position becoming too big a part of your portfolio, because as a investment runs up, it becomes a bigger and bigger percentage of your pool. And so in those cases, you want to be trimming your holding to keep that in position, so you de-risk as you go. And similarly, if it falls, you've got to ask yourself, well, is the reason I bought this still true, and would I buy it today? Then in that case, you might want to continue to hold. Mm. If the reason you bought it is no longer true, then it's time to cut your losses.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add to that is, Simon, I think we need to have a plan and not exactly. just understand the emotions of whether the share's trading well or not. Mm. I think there's two areas. If we sold, there's two areas we can place it. It's one is into lifestyle. So I go and buy a boat or mm-hmm. go on a holiday. Or two, I create some further wealth out of it maybe another asset that you think's going to perform better. So there's only two ways you can go with that. The first one is definitely emotion. That's cool. You've got to live your life on your own terms. But understanding what that plan is when you sell, or if you would sell, what are you going to do with it? Is it going to park in the bank? Is it going to go into something that's... Yeah.
You don't want to get too emotionally attached to your shares because they don't love you back.
No, they have nothing towards you, do they? Lindsay Whitehead, with interest rates rising into the 5 and 6% range for mortgages, should we be putting less money into those micro-investing apps like Raise or any other investment app, or ETF alternatives, and put it into or onto the offset accounts instead? What's the math equations to figure out where it'd benefit you more? Offsetting 5% with $1,000 on a $500,000 mortgage versus $1,000 in a Raise app that literally goes up and down so much, I don't know exactly how much benefit overall I'm getting. Just an example. Thanks in advance for your replies. Very good question at the minute, because it's very different to what it was 12 months ago. In the sense that interest rates were 2 and 3% instead of 5 and 6%. So does that change the decision-making based on the rates?
It shouldn't really. I mean, psychologically, it has a huge impact. So let me come back to that. But generally, interest rates rise as inflation rises, and the returns you should expect on an investment should similarly be relatively stable in inflation-adjusted terms. So if you were getting a 5% return when inflation was 2, you should probably be expecting to get 6 or 7 when inflation is 4 or 5. So that's the long-term answer. Now, it can take a long time for markets to get used to that. And when the initial increase in interest rates happen, often investments fall. So short answer to the question is that in the very short term, like within a year, you're probably more likely to do better more reliably better on the parking against your home loan. But in the longer term, in the 5, 7, 10, 15 plus years, even at higher interest rates, you are likely to come out ahead. But this is not purely a maths problem. That you know, your parking money against your home loan gives you certainty, helps you pay off your home loan faster, and it's generally fairly easy to set up and easy to reverse because you just pull it out of your offset again. Investing in shares takes a little bit more work. You got to work out what to buy. You got to set up a brokerage account. You got to put some money in. You got to buy it. You got to work out when to sell it. You got to do some tax, and you pay. Sorry, you got to do some tax return stuff, and then eventually you're going to pay tax when you sell it. So all of that takes time. Share prices do go up and down, as Lindsay says, and it's very hard to predict what it's going to be worth tomorrow. It's a little easier to predict what it's going to be in 20 years' time, and that's the game. And then, of course, there's the psychological comfort. You know, if your home loan is big as a percentage of the value of your property, or it, your weekly monthly payments are big relative to your income, then the flexibility of getting your home loan down to more comfortable levels has a huge psychological win. So mathematically, you know, one of the biggest questions we always get asked as financial advisors is, you know, do I pay off my home loan, invest, or put more money in super? Over the long term, after tax, super is always going to be the better answer. But it means giving up the money to 860. Yeah, it means you still have a big home loan. And so it's as much a personal circumstances as a mathematical problem. If you want to know the maths, there is actually a detailed analysis of this in an article on our website.
So looking, Lindsay, great question. Looking mathematically, we put $1,000 in your example against a 500K home loan. At 6%, we save $60 a year. Like, not groundbreaking. You put $1,000 into a Raise app and it performs at 6%, same outcome. So maths...
Ignoring the tax for a moment.
Yeah. So maths don't really take a part in it. What I would look at is, I see it as four pillars. Reduce your home loan, increase your savings, increase your assets, minimize your tax. So I would say both. Like, stick to your plan of raise, put an amount in that you're comfortable with, pay down that home loan with the remainder P&I and have some money sitting in the offset if there's some left over. Like, $1,000 there or there is not going to change your life either way, is it?
Yeah, that's right. So over the last 20 years, you probably would have done about 8.5% in Vanguard Diversified High Growth.
Yeah.
And you would have paid on average about 5% on your home loan. So over the long term, it will be the mathematically better answer. That is investing instead of paying off your home loan. But, you know, is the answer better this week or next week or this month or this quarter or this year? That's a much harder punt to make.
Just set what you're comfortable with. Very good question, Lindsay. Thank you. All right. Vince, what is your number one tip for buying your first house slash apartment slash unit slash something to live in?
You know, this is one of those really hot topics. You know, we still, you know, despite slightly declining home ownership rates and people doing it later in life, it still is a, you know, one of those bookends of financial life for most people, whether that's somewhere to live or somewhere to as an investment. But it's also one of the ones that causes the most grief for people. You know, if I were to look at the causes of financial stress in people that I see in my profession, it's having bought too much house or too much car. And it's very easy to find yourself in the buy too much house trap. You know, if you go to an open house and you ask an agent, how much will this sell for? They're going to say something like, oh, this will sell in the low 700s, which is sort of agent code for 710 to 750. As if those two numbers were immaterially different, whereas actually the difference between paying 710 and paying 730 will pay for a lifetime of lattes. So, you know, getting the buy right is actually the key to it. So not buying too much and buying at the time that's right for you. And so one of those, working out whether it's the right time, is, you know, have you decided where you actually want to live? Are you going to be there for a while? Do you know what you actually want? And test driving it a little bit. So if you you know, typically you can rent more cheaply today than you could buy today. So typically
in the location you want.
Yeah, so let's say you're in Sydney. Typically rental yields are probably about 3 to 4 maybe, which means that a $1 million house will rent for $30,000 to $40,000 a year, which is $600 to $800 a week. You couldn't borrow $800,000 to buy that property for that price. So the buying argument, if I buy, I'm going to pay more in weekly outgoings because I'm going to pay interest at a higher rate than I can rent it. I'm going to pay, I'm going to have to pay some principal back over 30 years. I've got to pay rates. I've got to maintain it. I've got to pay for the all those other bills that you don't pay when you're a renter. But the advantage of buying is that you've now fixed the price because rents will continue to go up at inflation plus. So at some point over your ownership journey, the rent will actually exceed your cost of operating. The question is, how long will that take?
Yeah.
But the argument that says, oh, look, I couldn't afford to buy a $1 million house, but I can actually pay $700 a week in rent. If you can save the difference between that rental amount and what it would cost to own it without affecting your lifestyle unacceptably, then, you know, if you try doing that for 6 months and see how uncomfortable or how comfortable it is, then that will give you an idea whether you're buying too much house or not.
Okay, so not sure if I got your number one tip, but we'll come back to it. KD Tax says, you don't have to buy your forever home straight up. It can be a home slash area that's good for now, not good forever.
I think that's good advice that, you know, it can be tempting to, you know, if you've lived at home with mum and dad till you're 27 or 28, enjoying the good life, it can be tempting to say, oh, I'm not going to live somewhere I can't have the same level of comfort and quality.
And that's a big one for people.
That's a big step into the buying too much house.
Yep.
So buy the right amount. Now, because of stamp duty, you know, you obviously want to look ahead a few years. So you don't want to buy what's good for today but won't be good in 2 years' time. But, you know, you do have to start somewhere.
Yeah, and I must add, this is a question that was put into the Facebook group during the week here. Melanie Poole says, decide on the long-term plans now. If you plan to have it as an investment in the future, the way you handle repayments might be different to if you don't. Also, the choice of property might be different, e.g. buy for demographic of the area, not your preferences. I'm sort of with you, Melanie, on that one, but also thinking, well, regardless of whether it's my principal place or an investment, I want to create the best wealth experience from that.
I mean, the conclusion she draws is correct, saying that almost regardless, but in her particular point, she's saying that if you plan to rent it out later, you should think about that today. And that's sound advice.
Yeah, and in particular to things like offset accounts and whatever.
The danger, though, is trying to have a bet each way and that the ideal investment property is unlikely to be the same as the ideal property to live in.
Yeah.
And trying to satisfy both tests at the same time, A, makes the buying process more fraught, and B, you're likely to compromise on you'll end up with the worst of both worlds rather than the best of both worlds.
That's right, yeah. This one here got the most likes, and this is my number one tip as well, Natalie. So well done. Natalie Bridges says, make sure you can service a loan on a much higher interest rate or on one wage if there are currently two of you and you want kids. Go for something that still lets you enjoy your life instead of having all your money tied up in the mortgage. A first home does not need to be the be-all and end-all.
Definitely agree with that. And that goes back to my point about, you know, buy property not too much when the time is right for you and test drive it first. So live your life as if you are paying the mortgage payments and the maintenance and the cost of living and see how you go. Because it can be, there are lots of restrictions you're prepared to put up with if you think, look, I'm saving really hard for 2 years. I can cut out a lot of stuff and bear it for 2 years. But if you're, you know, committing to do this for potentially 30 years, that's a completely different set of analysis.
Yeah, totally. And just on the, and there's a few more comments here, but I suppose depends on the time frame in which you want your dream home, or even if you know your dream location yet. Like for me, I was traveling around the countryside working and enjoying life. And for me, my dream location, I didn't know until 10 years down the track. Mm. So it was a rent vesting strategy until I actually knew what it was. But the key is we've got to be taking action in some way. We don't want to be just renting and just doing nothing else.
That's right. And I think one of the this gets dealt with by someone else's one, but like just because you can borrow the money to buy it doesn't mean you should.
Yes, Taylor Hughes.
That if you go and have a look at any of the calculators on you know, lenders' websites or on the internet, you'll generally find that you can borrow
a lot
more than is comfortable to repay. So most of the calculators will get you to somewhere around 6 to 7 to 8 times your gross income.
Mm.
And that, even at lower interest rates, that would have a material impact on what else you can spend your money on.
Yeah.
And you want to be very careful of making those trade-offs, especially if interest rates
get on the up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wendy Nutt, she's got something very practical. Measure everything. My first car wouldn't fit in so many tiny garages, and the agent's solution, just buy a new car.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's okay for the agent to say that, isn't it?
Agents would say that, wouldn't they?
Like we're all made of money. So I made sure everything would fit easily. So many places don't have floor plans with measurements, so I'll do my own. So take a tape measure is Wendy's advice there, which is fantastic advice. And there was another one to also say, don't skimp on a building and pest by Sheridan Regan. So that's also very important. And to hire the appropriate solicitor, don't self-act.
I got a gift of this little device that's got a laser in it.
Oh,
you just point it at the wall and it gives you the measurement. It is just...
That is laziness at its best,
isn't it? It's not obvious to the agent what you're doing, and you can quickly jot down the measurements. And even where there are floor plans, agents are terrible for this. The measurement isn't necessarily clear where it's measured to.
Yeah.
And certainly living areas and bedrooms are a prime example here.
Yeah,
but you can draw some rules of thumb. Like if you've got a bedroom where the smallest dimension's less than 3 metres, that's a good sign that your bed might not fit.
Yeah. So the laser wasn't pointed at the agent's heart. It was actually to the wall, wasn't it?
Yeah, it probably should have been. Yeah. Sorry, no offence to any agent listening here.
No, we love agents out there.
The other big one that I find causes problems is people get very obsessed about the 20% deposit.
Mm.
So to avoid this lender's mortgage insurance thing. But one of the worst things you can possibly do is drain your emergency stash to get just below 80.
Yes.
And... that's not just me saying that. If you look at the statistics of mortgage defaults, now we don't have very high defaults in Australia generally, but there's a spike in loans where the initial loan-to-value ratio, that is the ratio of the loan amount to the value of the property, was 79%.
Yeah.
So I think that tells you something.
It does.
Drain your emergency stash to get there. You know, what do you do when you've got to replace the keys or the boiler doesn't work or
interest rates go up or something.
Or interest rates go up. But there's always something you're going to have to do when you move in.
Yeah.
Something's not going to fit. Like your fridge doesn't fit in the hole in the kitchen, which goes back to...
Sharon, was it?
Wendy's suggestion.
Yep.
But it's pretty hard to get them all right. Something will need repair or replacement as soon as you move in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so leaving yourself skint or you've budgeted for... quarterly rates and you find that the vendor paid up for the whole year and you've now got to reimburse him for the rest of the year. These vendor adjustments can often catch people unawares.
At the last minute too.
And
2 hours to go.
Yep. And you suddenly find you've got to run another $1,000 in rates checks to the vendor.
Funny you mentioned the 20% deposit. You might have heard on the grapevine, the Spotify exclusive My Millennial Daily.
No. You know. Does that come with free LMI?
No, but...
Or a 20% deposit?
No.
You only have to listen to a fifth of it?
It's just Glenn, Shell and I giving little 5-6 minute tips each day on Spotify. So tune in if you haven't already. Week one was at the time of recording this week.
Mm-hmm.
Next week is exactly that. how to purchase a house without a 20% deposit. So tune in if you haven't already. If you're not on Spotify, you need to get yourself across there and take a listen to My Millennial Daily.
Excellent. That sounds like a good one.
Just a bit of a
plug. But not instead of Trip M3, though. This is as well. You've got to broaden your horizons.
Yeah, you can just use Spotify as your podcast go-to. You're still listening to M3. You're still listening to My Millennial Property, of course.
You could just add it to your playlist, couldn't you?
You could, yeah. There you go. All right. Well, Vince Scully, always a pleasure.
John Pidgeon, it's been a pleasure.
And until next time, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you soon.
Catch you next time. Bye for now.
We acknowledge the Awabakal people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast. My Millennial Money supports a variety of charities, and we encourage you to consider giving as part of your overall financial strategy. If you would like some giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to mymillennial.money/charities for more info. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.